dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Tonight, in our second hour of the program, we're going to continue with readings from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt. On the unacknowledged political nature of professional work and the training process that leads to a professional class accepting of ideological subordination. In our first hour, Canadian author and journalist Naomi Klein will illuminate George Bush's statement that resisting Iraqis don't want freedom by drawing parallels between the looting of Argentina under a so-called free market regime that led to its collapse and the corporate fire sale that is behind the war and so-called reconstruction in Iraq.
No fat rich man's pony can overtake you. There's not a rider from east to west can hold you alive in this dark.
Naomi Klein has covered the anti-globalization movement for the Toronto Globe and Mail, as well as other publications, and is the author of two books, No Logo, No Space, No Choice, No Jobs, and Fences and Windows, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Globalization Debate. For the past year, she's been making a documentary in Argentina on the new social movements that have emerged as a result of the economic crisis. She spoke at the University of Washington on October 9th.
I picked up the Seattle Times this morning, or rather it was slipped under my hotel door. I don't know if you guys saw this, but there's this funny cover story about the CEO of Boeing, the commercial jetliner wing of Boeing. It's a very, very funny story, because this guy, Alan Mulally, is that how you say his name? Mulally, am I pronouncing it right? As you probably all know, he's shopping around looking for a nice, comfy place to build his new jets. And it's the usual thing. You know, it's kind of like a personal ad, like single white guy seeks willing partner for short-term commitment, no taxes, no regulation, no unions, no cats. Now, your state has done a wonderful job of sort of quaffing itself and getting itself ready for the big date. It's cut workers' compensation, it's cut unemployment benefits, it's offered a special Boeing tax break. But Mr. Mulally, he's not impressed. And yesterday, he was asked by a reporter after the speech that he gave what he thought of Washington's investment climate. And he replied eloquently, graciously, patriotically, "I think we suck." Very charming. "I think we suck." And afterwards, I think he was worried that this might not be very good public relations for Boeing, this saying to the state where you do your business that you suck. So he tried to correct it, and he said to the press, and they, you know, to their credit, reported that he tried to get them not to say the word suck. And he said, what I really mean is we've got a lot of work to do. That's what he meant by suck. Now, this little exchange between the Boeing chief and the people of the state was kind of like a display of legalized extortion, which we've all gotten used to, right? And it has a lot to do with my talk tonight, which is about economic warfare and military warfare and the connections between the two, and I think Boeing provides actually quite a lovely bridge. I want to talk about a place that's undergone more than its share of corporate extortion of late, Argentina. I've been living in Argentina for the past year. I was in Argentina when the U.S.-led attack on Iraq began. And it was, I think, quite a unique place, a vantage point from which to watch the war. I mean, let's place it, we all watched the war on TV. I watched it on Argentine TV. And I did get an interesting perspective because 90% of the population was fully against the war. And there were big anti-war demonstrations in Argentina, as in there were in everywhere in the world. But at these demonstrations, there was a very common refrain, which was that the war in Iraq is essentially an exaggerated version of the war that was being waged in Argentina. Argentines talk about economic terror. And this is a country that knows quite a lot about terror. And I'm going to come back to that. But this is a country that has lived through such a profound economic crisis in the past 5 years that the economic crisis actually has many of the same effects as a real war. It's true that the bombs aren't dropping, but you have these other warlike effects, which are mass displacement of people, the creation of huge numbers of migrants and refugees, serious bodily harm, and death. These are warlike conditions. Now, it's quite remarkable that this is happening in Argentina. Argentina, for a long time, saw itself, much to the dismay of other Latin Americans, as sort of an honorary European country. Buenos Aires was nicknamed the Paris of Latin America. And in truth, Argentina's living standards were far more comparable to those in Canada or Italy than to those in Bolivia. You had a huge working class that was able to make that leap to the middle class, to send their kids to university, to take vacations, because they had very strong unions. And then there was another boom, which was the 90s boom in Buenos Aires, which was kind of a sort of Seattle-esque boom. And during the 90s, Buenos Aires was a hive of Asian fusion restaurants and cappuccino bars and martini bars and Evian spas, and they had one of the highest rates of per capita plastic surgery in the world. Now, as you know from living through a 90s boom, much of that wealth ended up being an illusion. It came from a series of one-off deals, the privatization contracts, the selling off of the country. Everything was sold in Argentina, even the street signs. They say, brought to you by MasterCard. Speculative finance and all of this covered over a massive amount of debt and accounting fraud. And I actually think it's quite interesting that the same month that Enron declared bankruptcy, so did the country of Argentina. 2 years ago, the bubble burst. Today, you have these warlike conditions where in this country that had the highest wages in Latin America, which had almost no unemployment, 60% of the population lives officially in poverty, which means they don't have enough to eat. You have an unemployment rate that's between 20 and 30%, and 27 children die of malnutrition every day. This is a country that is the breadbasket, that produces a huge amount of food for export, and yet people are going hungry. And that's why people talk about economic terror, about economic warfare, and this idea that Iraq is a high-intensity version of what they're living through every day. Now, of course, there are differences, but I want to talk a little bit more about the similarities. Now, in Argentina, this economic regime that crashed 2 years ago was first introduced with a real war. It's called the Dirty War, and it was waged under a military dictatorship that was somewhat similar to the military dictatorship in neighboring Chile. There was a coup in 1976, and the military stayed in power until 1983. But the generals in Argentina learned something from what Pinochet did wrong in Chile, because Pinochet's human rights abuses were out in the open, massacred people, assassinated the president. And that was in 1973, and it caused a huge amount of international outrage. So by the time the generals in Argentina came to power, they had already hired public relations firms who told them that they couldn't be so overt about it. So what they did is, instead of killing people, they disappeared them. Argentines turned disappeared into a verb. During the military dictatorship, 30,000 people disappeared into thin air. They were kidnapped from their homes without any explanation. Usually a Ford Falcon would pull up in front of the house, and plainclothes police officers or soldiers would come out, grab a political activist or a union organizer, throw them into the Ford Falcon blindfolded, and they were never seen again until the bodies would wash ashore. And that was what gave birth to a very powerful political movement, the Mothers of the Plaza de Mayo, whose children, who they would walk in front of the Plaza de Mayo and demand some explanation of where their children were. The terror in Argentina was so twisted, so profound, that when the international campaign started, it focused exclusively on the terror. They were human rights campaigns. But very few questions were asked about why the terror was being introduced, in whose interests, why the violence, why the disappearances. And this is normal, because terror of that kind of inhuman terror, treatment of people, it's so repelling to us as humans that it blinds us. I mean, we become incapable, paralyzed, from asking the questions of why. It almost begs you not to ask why. You want to believe that there can't be a reason for that type of inhuman treatment. But there were reasons for this economic warfare. Immediately after the coup, the generals brought in economic advisors, many of them from the States, most famously from the University of Chicago, just like in neighboring Chile. And they remade the country according to their economic textbooks. These are free market fundamentalists, and they were not allowed to implement these same policies in the United States because democracy got in the way. So they had the ideas, but they could never really do it. They couldn't cut all regulation of government. They couldn't privatize everything. They couldn't just suddenly slash wages by 50%. But in Argentina, where you had the social control of a military dictatorship, they were able to kind of turn the country into a free market laboratory. So they did slash wages by 50%, and they slashed government funding, and government regulation was eliminated in the name of foreign investment. Now, there were a few people who were able somehow to see past the horror of the disappearances and name the economic agenda behind the dirty war. One of them was a man named Rodolfo Walsh, and on March 24, 1977, on the one-year anniversary of the military coup, in a climate of extreme repression, he was on the police's, the regime's most wanted list. They wanted him dead. There was no freedom of the press. He wrote a letter, and he mailed it. What he would do is he would write the letter, and then he would photocopy it, he actually used just Xerox or carbon paper, and then he would put them into envelopes and he would mail them to a chain of, this is before the internet, this was before indie media, okay? It would go into the mailboxes and you would be on the chain to receive one of Rodolfo Walsh's letters, and then you would try to get it to your friends. This was the way you got real information out. So on the one-year anniversary of the coup, he wrote this letter, which is a very, very famous piece of writing all over Latin America, but was actually only just translated into English recently. It's called An Open Letter from a Writer to the Military Junta. And he said something almost heretical. He said this: the disappearances are not the greatest suffering inflicted on the Argentinian people, not the worst violations of human rights which you have committed, addressed to the junta. It is the economic policy of this government where one discovers not only the explanation of the crimes, but a greater atrocity which punishes millions in the name of planned misery. He called it planned misery. And he described what he meant by planned misery. freezing wages with rifle butts while prices rise at bayonet point, abolishing all forms of collective bargaining, raising unemployment, an economic policy dictated by the International Monetary Fund, following a recipe applied indiscriminately from Zaire or Chile, in Uruguay or Indonesia. For Walsh, the military war was required to enforce what he saw as the real war, which was the economic war, the one that cracked the country open to foreign investors. Now, 2 hours after Rodolfo Walsh dropped that letter into a mailbox, he was surrounded by police on the streets of Buenos Aires and he was killed. It was the last thing he wrote. But many Argentines can recite this letter by heart, that passage that I just read to you about planned misery, they can quote at length, because they see it as a description, a prediction, a prescient one, of the structural adjustment reforms that continued under democracy. The economic program that Argentina has been living under and that failed so spectacularly 2 years ago goes by a lot of names. There's no consensus. Some people call it corporate globalization. Some people call it neoliberalism. Some people call it neoconservatism. The French call it savage capitalism, which I sort of like. For the purposes of tonight's lecture, I'm going to call it Mick Government, because it is a kind of a franchise. It's kind of a happy meal of policies that, like McDonald's, are supposed to work wherever you put them because they're perfect and they are designed by fundamentalists. And these policies are mass privatizations. Why? Because these give multinationals lots of public services and resources to buy, i.e. investment opportunities. That's what privatizations are. Mass downsizing of the public sector. Why? Because that makes sure that investors will have low taxes because they don't have to support a public sector with their taxes, and low wages because there will be high unemployment, a flexible workforce. And the third, after privatization and downsizing, is deregulation. Now, deregulation, according to the Mick government recipe, fits into two broad categories with two different goals. The first goal of deregulation is to basically eliminate the competition for foreign multinationals. So you go in and you say, look, you're not allowed to support your local businesses anymore with subsidies, agricultural subsidies, in Canada, Canadian content regulations in the media, because these poor multinationals say it's not fair. And they use the language of civil rights. And they say that it violates their investor rights to have a level playing field. So you have a Walmart that says, you know, you can't in any way subsidize a local retail industry. Or, and this is the other side of the deregulation, you can't put any restrictions on the mobility of these foreign corporations. Some of these restrictions might be like what China does, which is to say if you want to come invest in China, you need to partner with a local Chinese company, and you need to use Chinese labor, and that way we are going to build our local industry, and we're going to have technology transfers. All of these rules are banned under Mick government. Multinationals, once the local competition has been eliminated by destroying all the subsidies and supports, want to be free to move their money in and out. They don't want any restrictions on whether they can move their profits out of the country. They don't want to be told that they have to hire locally, and so on. So basically, it's a bill of rights and freedoms for multinational corporations. That's Mick government. Now, the result of all of this lubrication for businesses is the same as we see everywhere. It's the privatization of ever more parts of our lives, which become investment opportunities. So it's not just about selling more products across borders. It's about taking things that weren't products, that were in the public sphere, like education or healthcare or seeds or ideas, and putting them into the marketplace, enclosing them. It's about the enclosure and selling off of the commons, because that creates growth and expansion. Now, I've talked a little bit about how this enclosure, how this privatization affected Argentina when the bubble burst. And I think that you have probably witnessed some of this closer to home. I know Paul Krugman spoke last night about the incredible growing gap between rich and poor in the United States. And you're experiencing rising unemployment at the same time as the corporatization of your schools, more advertisements in schools, and so on. So these are familiar ideas. And I think it's really important to remember, you know, that we know this stuff. Because when after September 11th, and particularly after the war began in Iraq, we often heard from right-wing pundits that the globalization debate was over. Nobody wanted to talk about economics anymore. That was actually a Canadian newspaper that the headline on September the 14th was, "Globalization is so yesterday." And the idea was that now we were going to be talking about manly things, you know? We were going to be talking about bombs and terrorism and, you know, as if suddenly people didn't care about whether their water was affordable anymore or whether their food was genetically modified, because on CNN people were talking about terrorism and that's all that mattered. So that's why it's important, I think, to remember that actually this isn't new, that we've been talking about these policies, that we know them because we live them at home, we've seen them around the world. And that's why I want to talk about Iraq, not as something new and foreign and something completely different, a change of subject that we now have to wrap our heads around, but actually an exaggerated version of what we've been talking about all along. So, in Iraq, shock treatment, shock therapy, as these economic policies were called in Argentina and Chile and Russia, is being implemented through shock and awe military force. That's what's going on. And we need to have the courage, like Rodolfo Walsh, who wrote that letter, to see beyond our own shock and horror at the violence and the devastation of war, to ask why, in whose interest, why is it happening, what's actually going on. Because I think it really is very much in the interest of the people who are waging this war to tell us that we actually don't know anything about what's going on, that this is all new. So what I'm going to be talking about is the connections between what we have been talking about in the globalization movement, this economic program that was protested so famously and spectacularly in Seattle in 1999, and what is actually going on in Iraq. Now, why is it going on? I wish I could tell you it's some brand new invention of why it's going on. It's so boring. It's the same old thing. Iraq is a very rich country. It has an embarrassment of natural resources and public services that have yet to be privatized. Okay, most of the world has already been sold off, has already been exploited. Latin America has pretty much already been bought. Africa has pretty much already been bought. So have most parts of Asia. But oil wealth has kept the Arab world relatively protected and outside the world trading system. So you actually have 22 of the countries of the Arab Emirate that, 22 of the Arab League countries that are not part of the World Trade Organization yet, that actually haven't been cracked open. And their countries, their governments, like in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait, own the oil, and they own most of the economy. Now, Bush has openly stated that he wants to see an end to all that. It's not a secret. He announced that in 10 years from now, there's going to be a free trade zone in the Middle East. It's the next big project after Latin America, after the free trade area of the Americas, this Middle East free trade zone. But it has to start somewhere. They need a foothold in the region, and the foothold is Iraq. It's the wedge. It represents a massive new market opportunity. And it represents it, most importantly, at a time when the market is in decline, when it needs a boost. Last week, Senator John McCain put it very succinctly. He said this. He said, "Iraq is a huge pot of honey, and it's attracting a lot of flies." So I'm going to talk about the honey, the flies, and if we have enough time, how to build a better fly swatter. Now, some people say that the honey is oil. It's not just the oil. It's also the water. It's also the phones. It's also the roads. It's also the media. It's also the trains. It's also the planes. It's also the jails. It's also the police. Anything that can be turned into a commodity and sold for profit. The flies are named Bechtel, Halliburton, MCI, ExxonMobil, Wackenhut, Time Warner, Walmart, Boeing, News Corp, and so on. Now, before I go any further talking about Iraq's reconstruction, I want to say something very clearly, which is that the United States must compensate the Iraqi people for this war. They must have the resources to rebuild their destroyed country. The U.S. owes Iraq huge wartime reparations. It is a moral duty, and it must be met. Now, it is not being met. This thing called reparations, this thing called reconstruction, it's not reparations. The vast majority of the money that Bush is now asking Congress for, the latest $20 billion, it's not going to the Iraqi people for the reconstruction of their country according to their wishes. It's being parceled out, as you know, to U.S. firms selected by the Bush administration for this thing called reconstruction. Now, when you hear the phrase reconstruction, it sounds absolutely lovely and benign, right? You're going to fix the bridges, fix the roads, the hospitals, the schools, get the country back on track. It sounds like this happy Peace Corps mission of do-gooders in Iraq, clean the place up. These countries are not going to Iraq to rebuild it. They are going to Iraq to buy it. That's what they're doing there. Iraq, as we speak, is being transformed into the world's biggest shopping mall for U.S. multinationals and a few British multinationals. It is nothing short of the sale of the century. Bomb it, then buy it. Immediately after the war began, we started to hear about these reconstruction contracts being handed out behind closed doors by USAID. Now, these reconstruction contracts were different than the reconstruction contracts that are usually handed out after wars. For starters, the contracts to rebuild the education and the healthcare system in Iraq were not going to the Red Cross, to UNICEF, to nonprofit agencies, humanitarian agencies, that usually do this work. They were going to private U.S. education and healthcare companies that are the same companies that are pushing privatization of education and further privatization of healthcare here in the U.S. They see schools here and abroad as market opportunities. They've already, in fact, given the contract to print new Iraqi textbooks to U.S. publishers. And they're not even going to be printed in Iraq. Money has already, the contract to print Iraq's currency has already gone to a British firm. Now, let's talk about Bechtel. Bechtel has a contract worth what's now $1 billion. Even though we were told it was going to be capped at $680 million, it's already gone past $1 billion. They're overseeing roads, they're overseeing bridges, electricity grid, this type of reconstruction. Now, a lot of Iraqi entrepreneurs are angry about this because these jobs, and unemployment in Iraq is soaring, are key to getting Iraq's economy back on track. But the jobs are actually going, for the most part, to Americans. Now, the answer from Washington is Iraqi reconstruction is our booty. We bombed it, we bought it. This is the theory. And they're absolutely open about it. Anger at Bechtel is also mounting, not just because they're hogging the jobs, but also because they're not doing the work. Now, I'm going to quote The Economist because it's not a socialist rag and you can't, you know, blame me. Last issue of The Economist had an article about what Bechtel has accomplished so far with their billion-dollar contract. In 5 months, Bechtel has managed to rebuild 1 mile of road. In 5 months, of the 49 bridges that were bombed, work has begun on only 3 of those bridges. Half of Baghdad's phones are still out. Much of the electricity is still out. Now, of course, we can't talk about the reconstruction contracts without talking about Halliburton. where Dick Cheney used to be CEO. Now, Dick Cheney, I think most people realize this, but Dick Cheney still has his Halliburton stock options. He still has them, in addition to his $20 million buyout when he left to go become vice president. And he has been paid more than $350,000 while vice president of deferred compensation from those stock options. But Dick Cheney says that it is a cheap shot to say that there is any kind of conflict of interest between his relationship with Halliburton and the fact that Halliburton has gotten the most lucrative reconstruction contracts. So call me cheap, but I'm going to say it. Halliburton has gotten a $1.4 billion contract so far, but their contract is actually green-lighted to go up to $7 billion. And you can bet that it's going to go up to $7 billion. This is not something to be taken lightly, even for a huge company like Halliburton. Why? Because Halliburton was desperate for that cash injection. Last year, it looked as if Halliburton was going to go the way of Enron. I don't know if you remember this, but they were mired in accounting scandals, and also they were mired in a series of lawsuits relating to asbestos poisoning. So badly that their subsidiary, the subsidiary that's actually getting the contracts in Iraq, which is Kellogg Brown and Root, KBR, was about to file Chapter 11 bankruptcy this fall. Halliburton posted a $500 million loss last year. Things were not going well. This year, Halliburton stock price is up 77%, and they posted a $26 million profit. So, Iraq saved Halliburton's butt. That is not an exaggeration. The bottom line is that Dick Cheney, as CEO, got Halliburton into quite a lot of trouble. But as vice president, he has saved them from going the way of Enron. So what are they doing with the money? They're doing two things, and both of them have to do with privatization. One of them at home, one of them in Iraq. The first thing that Halliburton is doing through KBR is it is protecting Iraq's oil supply, putting out oil fires, repairing pipelines, so that the oil can eventually be privatized. Now, it's not going very well, like Bechtel, they're screwing it up, but we can talk about that later. The second involves domestic privatization. They are at the very vanguard, at the very front lines of the privatization of the U.S. Army. Now, since we're in Seattle, to explain what's going on, I'm going to use a Microsoft analogy. Now, many of you know, well, probably you're all work there or something. I might... Not anymore. You were probably a permatemp, which is my, which is what I was about to talk about. Good. All right. Well, you can vouch for this. A few years back, Microsoft rearranged things so that one third of its workforce was classified as temps or permatemps, as they called themselves, because they were actually jobs. Microsoft defined their core competency as top-level programming, and everything else was contracted and subcontracted out. Well, the exact same thing is happening to the U.S. Army, and Halliburton is the temp agency. George Bush has decided that the core competency of the U.S. Army is combat, and that everything else can be subcontracted. So what you have is a situation where Halliburton has an army of temp soldiers, 4,500 at the moment in Iraq. And basically, they're kind of like the army's wife, outsourced wife. They build the bases, they cook the food, they clean the latrines, they do the soldiers' laundry, and they even cut their hair. They also do security for the bases. And all of this is at cheaper prices, of course, with the profits going straight back to Halliburton. That's why they had posted a $26 million profit last year. One third of the Iraqi mission is subcontracted to private contractors. So in the budget, when you hear how much money is actually going to the military, one third of that is actually going to private companies like Halliburton, who are doing the jobs for a profit. So to recap, The U.S. government, looking for new investment opportunities for its ailing firms, wages an unprovoked war with a partially privatized army, cleans up after the war using many of the same for-profit companies. And here's the kicker. When everything's cleaned up, it's going to sell off pieces of Iraq to these very same companies. Now, I wish I could tell you that these contracts are actually going to go to the highest bidder, but they're actually going to go to the highest donor. Already, we're seeing this seamless integration from Iraqi reconstruction to Iraqi privatization. The goal is clear: not to rebuild, not just to rebuild Iraq's roads, but to turn them into privately owned and operated highways, not just to reconstruct the bombed out water system, but to sell it to a multinational company who can then charge high service fees for access, not just to put out the oil fires and protect the pipelines, but to sell the pipelines, of course. Now, this is not a conspiracy theory. This is all out in the open. There is no shame, friends, none. Bush, Rumsfeld, and Paul Bremer are now openly admitting that they see reconstructing Iraq as remaking the country into a deregulated free market economy. Bremer's choice of clothing, I think, is really appropriate. When he came to Iraq, he wore a flak jacket. I don't know if you remember this. This is the U.S. envoy in Iraq. He wore a flak jacket. And some public relations consultant must have told him that this wasn't sending the right message, that Iraq was open for business. So he changed into a suit, a business suit, but with combat boots. In August, Bremer wrote a memo to the Iraqi council. Now, of course, Bremer appointed the Iraqi council, giving them some instructions. And as appointees, he's an appointee. And so it's just, you've got the president's appointee giving instructions to his appointees about what they should do in Iraq. And whether the president is an appointee is something that we can discuss later. Now, in this memo, he told his appointees, that Iraq was too protected, too protectionist, and was dominated by socialist economic dogma, which is kind of weird because Saddam Hussein's a lot of things, but he's not a socialist. He was actually the answer to socialism, but we can talk about that later. And he said in this memo that the Iraqi council needs to, quote, pry open most of its industries for foreign investment. Now, sure enough, less than a month later, on September 19th, 200 state firms in Iraq were put up for sale. 200 companies, state companies, are now ready to be privatized. Reconstruction has turned into the auctioning off of a country, someone else's country. Now, I happen to believe that Iraq is not America's to sell, which is why I'm a little agitated about this. According to the new laws introduced by Bremer, U.S. firms can have 100% ownership of banks, mines, and factories of all kinds. The only exception is oil, but believe me, this is going to come. Bremer's already told the U.S. Congress that he has instructed the Iraqi government, whoever that is, that they need to also privatize the oil. Now that these companies are for sale, the people who are best positioned to buy them are the people who are already there. Obviously, their bids are going to be more competitive because they're already functioning in the region. That gives them a huge advantage over a European firm. So Bechtel's going to win over Suez or Vivendi when it comes to privatizing Iraq's water because they're already rebuilding it. It's already theirs. Now, of course, this is what Bechtel does. On the global stage, Bechtel is one of the most aggressive pushers of the privatization of water in the world, and they have a terribly shoddy record of it. In fact, they were thrown out of Bolivia, out of Cochabamba, Bolivia, a few years ago because when they privatized the water there, the prices went up 50%. And the other thing that people didn't like is that Bechtel told them it was illegal to collect rainwater because it was unfair competition. So it got all messy, and you know, now they're suing the government of Bolivia for lost revenues and all of this. Now, Iraq, they don't have any of these problems. They don't have to negotiate with a foreign government because there isn't a foreign government. What it is the U.S. government selling to U.S. corporations another country. They've cut out the middleman. It's genius. This was never about Reconstruction. It was always about privatization, disguised as Reconstruction. Mass robbery, disguised as reparations. Last week, the Washington Post ran a story about a brand new company, one of these companies that is made up of former White House officials and friends of George Bush. There's lots of them going, selling terrorism insurance. Okay. This new company is called New Bridge Strategies, and it is headed up and founded by none other than Bush's former campaign manager. Now, New Bridge Strategies is offering up its services to companies that want to set up shop in Iraq and take advantage of what it calls the unprecedented opportunities in that country. So they're kind of a broker. They've got good political connections. They say, come on, let's go to Iraq. And in this Washington Post story, they quoted anonymously one of the partners in New Bridge Strategies, and he explained the game plan. He said this. He said, getting the rights to distribute Procter & Gamble products would be a gold mine. One well-stocked 7-Eleven could knock out 30 Iraqi stores. A Walmart could take over the country. So, note the language. Knocking out, takeover. This is a hostile takeover. A hostile takeover of a country. Now, before that can happen, before Iraq can be turned into a wholly owned subsidiary of corporate America, a few more things have to happen. Now, I talked about the MIC government happy meal. One of them is privatization, but only one. The other two are downsizing of the state and deregulation. And you can bet that Paul Bremer is on to those as well. Downsizing. In his first month in Iraq, Paul Bremer fired 400,000 state employees and didn't give them pensions or reemployment programs. He called these mass layoffs de-bathification, which is the purging of Saddam Hussein's party officials from government. Now, de-bathification has to happen. They have to purge Saddam Hussein's henchmen and propagandists from government. But this is going way beyond that. This was absolutely indiscriminate layoffs of whole ministries, whole State Department, whole industries, low-level bureaucrats, no ties to the party whatsoever, laid off. So in the name of debathification, just as in the name of Reconstruction they launched privatization, in the name of debathification they have launched massive attacks on the public sector. Why are they doing it? For the same reason they do it here, for the same reason they did it in Argentina, because it lowers their taxes when they come in because they don't have to support it, and it creates new opportunities because these state industries that were downsized are the same state industries that are now being sold off, pre-downsized, pre-privatization downsizing. So, deregulation. Paul Bremer has that covered too. Now, Paul Bremer and George Bush like to talk about bringing the free market to Iraq as this wonderful opportunity for the Iraqi people. Now, we've already talked about how in the case of Reconstruction, the Iraqi businesses aren't even getting a shot at the contracts. But it goes way beyond that. There are a whole bunch of other ways that Iraqi companies are being pushed out of business under the Bremer regime. When Paul Bremer arrived, Iraqi-owned companies were obviously in really rough shape. These are companies that had been pummeled by 13 years of sanctions, by 2 months of looting, while the occupiers did very little to stop it, not to mention two wars. So if you were actually interested in bringing the free market to Iraq, it would have made sense to probably do a couple of things before these companies had to face international competition. You might have turned the lights back on. You might have gotten the phones back on. You might have waited for the spare parts that had been looted to arrive so that Iraqi factories could get back up and running, if you were serious about free market competition and a level playing field. That is not what Paul Bremer did. 26 days after George Bush declared the war over, With the phones and the lights still out in Baghdad, Paul Bremer declared Iraq open for business and flung the doors open. The market was flooded with cheap electronics, clothing, packaged food, and what happened was entirely predictable, which is that hundreds of Iraqi businesses went out of business, went bankrupt, because of course they couldn't compete, they didn't have electricity. So, once again, Iraq is not being rebuilt, it is being erased. First by war, then sanctions, then war, then looting, now with this absurdly unfair business environment, which they have no way of being able to compete in. Why? Well, if you're a Walmart and you wanted to wipe out 30 Iraqi stores, wouldn't it be nice if they were already wiped out before you even got there? If the competition was already eliminated? That's a friendly business environment. That's something Boeing could get behind. They got other goodies, too. When Bremer put those 200 state companies up for sale, he announced that foreign firms doing business would get a tax break. How big a tax break? From 45%, which was the highest income bracket at corporate tax rate, to 15%. 45 to 15. That's better than Bush at home. That's a serious tax break. He also removed all restrictions on taking profits out of the country. So, to sum up again, from a foreign investor's perspective, Iraq does not suck. Everything that these companies lobby for at home has been handed to them on a silver platter. They have all the privatization they want, they have all the downsizing they want, and they have exactly the deregulation that they want that gets rid of the local competition and allows them to move their money in and out of the country freely. Doesn't make any demands of them. This isn't replicating the U.S. system in Iraq. Don't let anybody tell you that. This is a laboratory like Argentina was during the Dirty War, a kind of a dream world for the most ideological of Washington's neoconservatives to build the world that they only see in their textbooks, to make it come to life. They're fully privatized, downsized, deregulated market economy, free base, free market economics. They're really getting off. Donald Rumsfeld recently said, I'm sorry that you're taking all this from a Canadian, you're brave, treasonous. Donald Rumsfeld said last month that, and this is a quote, Iraq, thanks to these regulations, will have some of the most enlightened and inviting tax and investment laws in the free world. That's how excited he was. But there's a catch. Iraq's not free. Iraq is under occupation. These decisions were made with no input whatsoever from the Iraqi people. So these core questions about what kind of country do you want? I mean, in Canada, these are the questions that are most fiercely debated. Do we want an American-style healthcare system, or do we want to continue to have a public healthcare system? Do we want to have public media, or do we want to only have a commercial media? What are we going to do with the revenues from our natural resources? Will we redistribute them, or will they simply go for export? This is governing. This is democracy, these questions. All of these questions are being made before the Iraqi people have a chance to make a single decision or elect a single representative. Now, this is quite staggering, okay? Let's be serious. This is shocking how quickly this is happening. They have not managed to rebuild more than 1 mile of road or start work on more than 3 bridges, but they have managed to completely remake an economy. In Argentina, it took 3 decades. It's taken them 6 months. Now, why are they doing this? It's not smart. From a security perspective, it is making people very angry. It is feeding the opposition to the occupation. The reason why they're doing such an ill-advised thing is because Bush doesn't have a choice. He's in a rush. He has an election coming. And in the parlance of the business world, he needs what is called a braggable. Do you know this word, braggable? It's something to brag about. He doesn't have Saddam Hussein to brag about. He doesn't have Bin Laden to brag about. he can't brag about Afghanistan because Afghanistan's a mess. And he hasn't found the weapons of mass destruction. And his numbers are plummeting. He needs to be able to say, yeah, let's have a little round of applause. He needs to be able to say on the campaign trail that he brought democracy to Iraq. He wants the photo op at the election booth. Now, if that's going to happen, if there's going to be some semblance of an election in Iraq before there's some semblance of an election in the United States, I'm really pushing it. It's terrible. He needs to get these reforms through now. He needs to get them through now because once there is democracy in Iraq, even if it's a thin democracy, people could decide that they actually don't want to sell off their whole country. But if the decisions are made before the elections, then the contracts are signed, then it would be expropriation. And the U.S. doesn't like that. There would definitely be retaliation. Basically, it would be all but locked in. So, in the name of democracy, the Iraqi people are being robbed of the most basic principle of democracy, which is the right to govern yourself, the right to self-determination. Because Bush knows that democracy is actually the enemy of these reforms, that if people had the ability to have direct input and participation, they actually would reject these anti-people policies. So what's going to happen is that when the Iraqi people emerge from the trauma of war and sanctions and looting, they are going to realize that their country has been sold out from under them. And then they're going to be told to hurry up and vote for their new leader before Bush's election and be welcomed to the wonderful world of democracy. Now, this is harrowing. I think it's harrowing. I think it's harrowing that it's not more of a scandal. It's all being reported. But I think that the outrage is missing. I hope I've tried to balance that out a little bit here tonight. The cynicism and the shamelessness of this project, I think, is frankly staggering. But I want to tell you something that I hope you will find less depressing. I certainly do. Now, on the surface, it seems that we're seeing true defiance, unilateralism, almost imperial power of the Bush team, that it's been unmasked. But I believe that that defiance is itself a mask. And what it's hiding is desperation. I think this whole project reeks of desperation, which isn't to say that desperation isn't dangerous. It's very dangerous. But the reason why there is this lunge for the untapped resources in Iraq is that capitalism functions a lot like a drug addict. And the drug is growth. That's the fix. Without a fix, without expansion, it dies. And fixes are hard to come by at the moment. The reason for that is that the rest of the world is cutting off the supply. So let's go back to Argentina, where we started. Since the economy collapsed, there has been an explosion of popular movements and a mass rejection of the policies of neoliberalism, which is what it's called, what McGovernment is called in Latin America. And you have a truly radicalized country that has forced the government to begin to stand up to the International Monetary Fund. I don't have time to get into the details of it, but Argentina is truly a country in revolt, which is starting to build genuinely radical economic alternatives. There are 200 factories that have been taken over by their workers and turned into cooperatives. In Brazil, Lula and all that he represents, whether he lives up to it, it's clear that he represents a rejection of these policies. That's who he is. Venezuela and the amazing resistance of Chavez, despite the most dogged attempts to get rid of him. Most importantly, I think, more than the election of these guys, the Lulas and the Chavezes and the Gutierrez and Nestor Kirchner in Argentina, is the fact that in these countries, when there is participatory democracy, when there is a referendum on privatizations. They are rejected every single time. And privatization has been stopped in its tracks in Latin America, not because the politicians are progressive, but because the people will not stand for it, in the same way that Bechtel was thrown out of Cochabamba. Now, this is another example that democracy is actually the true enemy of these reforms. And we're seeing the same thing happen now in response to the free trade area of the Americas. And I wanted to just let you know that there's a summit in Miami, a free trade area of the Americas summit. You should find out more about it and be part of what is truly a global a hemispheric rejection of this trade agreement. We just saw it in Cancun at the World Trade Organization meeting. It was quite amazing. You had pressure on the outside, people in the streets, but you also had something quite amazing, which was poor governments banding together and saying that they would rather have no deal than a bad deal and walking away. So what's happening is that what I'll call free trade light, which is trying to wrestle resources and market access at these through free trade agreements, through the World Trade Organization, isn't working anymore. Free trade light isn't working. And that's why they're getting desperate. That's why they have upgraded to free trade supercharged, which seizes resources on the battlefields of war. It doesn't ask because it knows the answer. It takes. That's the desperation. Now, the world isn't standing for this. There is massive opposition, and we saw it during the war in the explosion of a global, truly global anti-war movement. But we're also seeing it at the governmental level. And I'm not just talking about France and Germany. Even the U.S.'s loyal lapdogs, NAFTA friends, Canada and Mexico, did not support the war. And they didn't support the war not because out of principle. I mean, speaking from Canada, I can say that. I think that it's probably true for Vicente Fox as well. They didn't support the war because they had no choice, because their people were so against it that it was an untenable position. And this is happening more and more. Now, I don't think this is about anti-Americanism. I don't think what's being rejected here is the United States or the United States government. What's being rejected are these economic policies that are global in nature and that the U.S. happens to be the most aggressive pusher of. But I think that the anti-Americanism can become a huge and dangerous distraction. What we should be focusing on is what we have been focusing on in the globalization movement for many years now, which is these economic policies that wage war on people, that put profit before people. I think that the challenge for the next while has to be to not let war blind us to the reasons, the motivations behind both economic warfare and military warfare. If we look at what happened in Iraq, it's so clear that the attack was always part of the same war we've been fighting all along. It was waged to implement the same policies that are being protested around the world. In Cancun, in Argentina, in Quebec City, in Genoa, and most famously here in Seattle in 1999. Now, the task for anyone concerned about these things, and I think that there are a lot of people in this room tonight, is for the anti-war movements and the movements fighting the ravages of capitalism to better integrate, to cross-pollinate, to strengthen each other. And in so many ways, this process is already beginning. So that's the task, to remember what we know, to keep fighting. And in conclusion,